The book of Esther. You know, it's interesting. Esther and Ruth, you know, these books named after women, most people have this romantic view of what these books are about. And Esther, you know, people saying, oh, you know, what a wonderful love story. Well, I think Ruth is a wonderful love story, but Esther, you know, I've been reminded of it this week and just going through it time and time again this week. And I'll tell you, this is a dark and dismal book as far as I'm concerned. Now, you notice I didn't say that this morning because then you wouldn't have come. But I'll tell you that there's several things about the book. Number one, the Sunday school version of this is completely skewed in the wrong direction. The other thing that you might see is that because we were in Ezra and Nehemiah last week, remember that in Ezra, Cyrus, king of Persia, said to all the Jews that were still alive, left over from the Babylonian captivity, had said, hey, anybody who wants to go back to Jerusalem, feel free. Anybody that wants to go back to their homeland of Israel, go right ahead. I encourage you to go and to build or rebuild the temple. And a few tens of thousands of people went. Later on, Artaxerxes, who was the king at that time, the king of Persia, he said to Ezra, I want you to make the place righteous. I want you to govern it by the laws of God according to the scriptures and take all the people you want. And again, made an announcement to all the Jews living in his kingdom. Used to be the Babylonian kingdom, and now it was the Medo-Persian Empire. Said to all the Jews, hey, anybody that wants to go, go. Make the place more righteous, you know. Well, only a handful of people went that time. Between those two offers to return, less than 50,000 of the Jews went back to Israel. And so to me, now the book of Esther being set in the Medo-Persian Empire after the opportunity to leave, I don't see anything positive here. I see a bunch of Jews that decided that being in the world was better than being in the promised land, you know. And so as I see that, it's not a surprise to me to discover that this book is the only book of the entire Bible. Of the 66, it's the only book of the Bible that doesn't mention the Lord once. Not even once. And so that's kind of where people are at. And so it takes place, it says, in the days of Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus. People, if you're reading the NIV, you might be confused. Because I think there it refers to this king as Xerxes. Well, Ahasuerus is actually a title. It means venerable father. And it was the title, is the Hebrew name for the title of the kings of Persia. So they were all called, in the same way that in Egypt, they were all called Pharaoh. They all had their own name, certainly, but they were all called Pharaoh. In this case, in the Medo-Persian Empire, they were all called Ahasuerus. Well, the translators of the NIV decided that, well, as near as they could tell in history, the king at this point was Xerxes, so let's just plug his name in there. Well, I'll tell you, that when you do that, you cease to be a translator. And you start to be an interpreter. That's not what it says. The Hebrew word, Ahasuerus, is in the scriptures. I appreciate it when translators just translate and they don't insert. So it takes place in the days of Ahasuerus. And he sits on his royal throne there in the citadel of Shushan. Shushan was the capital at this point of the Medo-Persian Empire. It originally had started in Babylon, as we saw early in the days of the book of Ezra. But they had relocated the capital. You know, it's no fun having a used capital. If I was going to conquer the United States, this is purely my plan. no, this is purely speculation, but you know, I don't think that I would have to use Washington DC in the beginning, but then, you know, I'd probably want to move it, establish my own capital. Maybe Pine Bluffs. I like that. Pine Bluffs, the capital of the United States. They relocated from Babylon to Shushan. And so Shushan is the capital at this point, and it is in the citadel in Shushan, the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. This is in Iran today. And so As you notice in scriptures, when, and we talked about this in our study on Thursday night of not this Thursday night because that was Christmas, but recently in our study of First Chronicles on Thursday nights, we talked about how God takes place names, the original inhabitants and the original settlers of places, and keeps the names so that regardless of what your atlas and your globe does, and regardless of the global politics of the day, you can always go back and find out of which country God is speaking. And you'll notice that when Persia is mentioned, for the most part, you're talking about Iran. And so the capital of the Persian Empire being there in Iran, in Shushan. So this guy, the third, he's been king for 3 years, it says in chapter 3, and he gives a banquet for all his princes and attendants and army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces, being held in his presence, and he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for 6 months, for 180 days. What we see is this guy's humble heart. You know, I just want to bless the people with a party. No, he's gathering them all together to demonstrate his great riches and his grandeur and his greatness. Well, when these days are completed, then the king gave a banquet for that lasted a week, 7 days, for all the people who were present at the citadel in Shushan, from the greatest to the least in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So now he's getting all the townsfolk involved, all the palace servants, if you would. Okay, you know, we've had this 6 month party, so now we're going to have a week long party for you. And it goes on to describe how all these things were outfitted and how people were drinking. Certainly it says the royal wine was plentiful and people could drink as much or as little as they wanted to. Now, I don't know about your experience in the world, but when there's an open bar, I haven't really experienced people drinking as little as they wanted to. I've experienced people drinking as much as they wanted to, and certainly everybody's hearts are quote-unquote merry with wine. Now, in the meantime, this is all the guys. This is all the guys. But in the meantime, Queen Vashti, it says in verse 9, is also having a party, having a banquet for the women in the palace. And so 7 days into this, a week-long party has gone by, and the heart of the king was merry with wine. And they must have got into this conversation about their good-looking wives, you know, because the king gets it in his head that he commands these seven eunuchs who served in his presence to bring out the queen. You know, we want her to display her beauty. So they must have got into this one-upsmanship kind of thing where it's like, my wife's better looking than your wife. And, you know, after 7 days of drinking, the guys will argue about anything. And so Queen Vashti is ordered before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. Now, what doesn't come across here that many Hebrew students and Hebrew scholars believe is that the royal crown was all that she was ordered to bring. You get the idea there, that, you know, come and display your beauty wearing only the royal crown. Other students of history believe that it was, for various reasons, there's the thought that she may have been pregnant and all these different ideas of why she didn't come. But she did not come. She refused to come, it says in verse 12, at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. So he's been drinking, he's showing off, you know, bragging about his wife's beauty, treating her like a trophy, an object. Now he's getting angry. And the king said to the wise men there, who understood the times, and it lists them all in verse 14, he says, what are we supposed to do? According to the law. And in the Medo-Persian Empire, the law was the law was the law. It meant so much. People weren't looking for ways to get around the law like they are today. But in fact, when the law was decreed, it was as if God himself had spoken. And so he says, according to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. Well, these guys say, well, she's not only wronged the king, but all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces. You know, king, she hasn't just wronged you. She's wronged every guy in the entire Medo-Persian Empire. Huh? Well, they said, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands. Now, ladies, I know that you don't need a queen to help you look with contempt upon your husband, right? They give you enough ammunition for that. And yet these so-called wise men, they're saying, well, you know, if the queen gets away with this, certainly what's going to happen is that all the women are going to start disobeying all the husbands of the land. And the ladies of Persia and Media will begin to speak in the same way to all the guys. And there will be plenty of contempt and anger. And so here's the deal. Let a royal edict be issued that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. Then all the women will give honor to their husbands. And so the king agreed. He sent letters to every province that every man should be the master in his own house. So the queen put in the unused pile in the harem there, banished for all the rest of her life, not to come into the presence of the king anymore, that she would not get the special place of the one woman in the harem who was considered to be queen. A dark time, a sick society, with the multiple wives and the king picking his favorite to be the queen. And when he gets tired of her, when she does something he doesn't like, well, just put her in that room with the women I don't want to see anymore. And that's what the rest of her life is going to be spent like. And that guys, you know, that guys are going to be the master of their own house because of the decree of the law that, hey, you see what happens if your wife disobeys, you know, just send her away. And certainly an ungodly society. Well, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, chapter 2 begins, he remembered Vashti, and the king's attendants tried to get his mind off of his no longer to be a wife, and he couldn't change it. Remember, it had been a royal decree. There was no way he could say, well, I'm not mad anymore. I'm not going to, you know, I'll pretend like I never said that. You can't do that. And so the king's attendants came up with this great idea. They thought, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king and gather every beautiful young virgin from all across your great, you know, kingdom, your empire, to the citadel of Shushan, to the harem. And then let the young lady, it says in verse 4, who pleases the king, be queen in place of Vashti. So here's the idea. Get every beautiful virgin in our entire nation here, in our whole empire, and you can just cycle through them one after the other until you find one that you like. That's the story. Again, a dark time happening in human society there. Now, we're introduced in verse 5, there was in Shushan a Jew whose name was Mordecai. And Mordecai was a Benjamite. Remember the tribe of Benjamin, some of the guys that you might know from the tribe of Benjamin, King Saul. King Saul had been of the tribe of Benjamin. Later on, the Apostle Paul would be born from the tribe of Benjamin. And he, of course, had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled when Nebuchadnezzar came in. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. Hadassah was her name in Hebrew, but Esther was her Persian or Babylonian name because her father and mother had died, and so Mordecai has taken her in as his own daughter. He's raising her as his daughter. Now Esther, being a beautiful young virgin in the empire, is brought into the king's palace. Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now, verse 10 says that Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, meaning that she didn't say, hey, I'm Jewish, because Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Hey, don't tell anybody you're a Jew. I don't know why he said that, but it may have been for her safety that the queen, if she did happen to become queen, that, you know, they might not want a Jewish queen, and so she would be eliminated there. Every day, Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now, when the turn of each young lady came to go into Ahasuerus, and again, this is the sick and twisted real reality of this, is that the king is being with this with a different woman every night, if you would, and kind of testing them out. I don't know how to describe that politely. I think it's interesting that, you know, when the kids watch VeggieTales, there is the story of Queen Esther. Well, in that story, in the VeggieTales, it's a beauty contest. Well, this is not a beauty contest. This is something far darker and more immoral than a beauty contest. So the young lady would go into the king, and anything that she desired to take with her, she was given to take with her from the harem into the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the custody of the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So you see what he's doing. Every evening, the king is being physically intimate with a virgin in the kingdom, and then in the morning she is put in the discard pile. But she's going to stay there forever, and that's the only thing she'll ever do. She'll be in the harem there until the day that she dies. And so he's just basically cycling through woman after woman after woman until he finds one that he wants to make queen. So this is not a beauty contest. This is just a really dark and despicable kind of thing. Well, ultimately, it says in verse 17 that the king loved Esther more than all the women. Now, I do want to point out that the Hebrew word for love is just like the English word for love. It can mean anything. We make a big deal out of the Greek words for love, about agape, you know, being unconditional love, and eros being the physical, sexual love, and phileo being the love of friendship. So the Greek language is all these terms for love, but English, we can say, you know, I love my wife, I love my new shoes, and I love chocolate cake, you know. And they all mean very different things, but it's the same verb. In Hebrew, it's the same thing. And so we don't know exactly where the king was coming from. He liked her better, you know. He was pleased by her more. He may have genuinely loved her. He certainly showed favor and kindness to her, more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So should we really rejoice about Esther becoming queen? Well, Esther's just one of however many hundred women went before her, and she just happens to be the one that he likes the best, and not a really great job. And as we'll see, there's really nothing to being the queen in the Medo-Persian Empire. It's not like she's the Queen of England, you know, where she's legislating laws and sitting on the throne next to the king and stuff. She's like most favored woman in the harem, so she gets the crown. And so Mordecai, he's been sitting at the king's gate. Before, he was sitting as close as he could to the door of the harem so that he could find out how she's doing. And now he's sitting at the king's gate again to find out how she's doing. Well, as he's sitting here at the king's gate, two of the king's officials became angry and started plotting against the Ahasuerus, or wanted to, like, this assassination plot. Well, he finds out about the plot, and so he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. They investigated the plot, found it to be so, and were both hanged on a gallows. That can also be interpreted from the Hebrew as impaled on poles or nailed to trees, that they were both put to death. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. And that's it. End of story, until this factors in later on. So you kind of keep a mental note of, hey, Mordecai discovered this plot while he was there watching out for Esther's interests there. After these events, Ahasuerus promoted Haman. You know, the Feast of Purim happens every year on the Jewish calendar, and this book is the reason that Purim was instituted. This book is the reason for the festival. We'll find out about that. But every year, the book of Esther is read at the Feast of Purim in the synagogues throughout the world. And when Haman's name is mentioned, all the Jews hiss and stamp their feet. You know, it's like, boo, boo kind of thing. And so because he's just such a horribly wicked, wicked guy. And so this guy has risen in authority over the kingdom to having been promoted by the king. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to him, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now, this is not a lack of respect. This is a lack of worship. The Jews certainly didn't have a problem bowing in respect to people that deserved respect. However, they were following the command to bow down and worship Haman. And so this is why Mordecai would not do this. Well, the king's servants confronted Mordecai, saying, "Hey, why are you transgressing the king's command?" Well, he was explaining to them that he was a Jew and he couldn't do that. Well, they told Haman, and when Haman saw that, they said, "Hey, there's a guy who is a Jew that refuses to bow down in homage to you." And the next time Haman went through, there's this one guy standing. Everybody else is bowing down in homage, and there Mordecai is standing up. Well, he was filled with rage, verse 5 says. But for some reason, he didn't just have Mordecai put to death. Because the guy was a Jew, and he had said, "Well, I won't bow down and worship anybody because I'm a Jew," then why? Let's have all the Jews put to death, is what he thought. He sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom. And so it was the first month of the year, and they began to cast Pur, that is, the lot. They began to cast at least three of them, because ultimately we find out that this whole event is named Purim. When you put the I am at the end of a Hebrew word, it means three or more. And so you have Purim, the Pur being cast basically over the calendar. And each day over the calendar, if we were to do this today, we'd be rolling three dice, you know, and saying, "Okay, let's see what day we're going to put the Jews to death on. January 1st, roll the dice." Nope. Let's say we've got to get three sixes. January 2nd. Nope, no three sixes. January 3rd. They went day by day, week by week, month by month through the whole year until the lot was cast over the 12th month. On a certain day of the 12th month, this is the day we're going to kill the Jews. So this was a very superstitious, false god dependency kind of thing. Fortunately, the Bible tells us that the lot is cast into the lap, but the result is the Lord's, you know. It doesn't mean, you know, you go to Vegas and play the tables and go, "Hey, man, it's up to the Lord," you know. Because the Lord may say, "Yeah, and I'm going to empty your bank account, buddy." Well, the Lord directed this, that it's going to happen 12 months from now, and he's got it all worked out, and God is working behind the scenes in the book of Esther, even though he's not mentioned or acknowledged at this point. And so Haman comes to the king and says, "You know, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different than the laws of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws." Well, that's a pretty blanket statement, isn't it? Mordecai, one Jew, refusing to obey one law, and that gets exaggerated to be all the Jews observe none of the king's laws. Well, if I was the king, I'd be upset too. And so he says, "If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed." And he offers to put some money in the treasury to make it all happen. Well, the king takes his signet ring and says, "Hey, you know, go ahead and do with them as you please. You know, use my ring to sign whatever command you want to do." So they wrote these letters of decree and stamped them with the king's signet ring. The letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews on the 13th day of the 12th month. And as added benefit, if you would, as added incentive to destroy the Jews, when you destroy the Jews in a household, you can have their household. You can have anything. If you kill them, you can have anything that they own. Well, the king and Haman sat down to drink that day, but the city of Shushan was in confusion. And Jews, as these letters were delivered, certainly they arrived in the city first, and Mordecai wept bitterly and put on sackcloth and ashes and just was weeping and wailing. And city by city, as the couriers would come with these letters, and all the Jews would be thrown into confusion and despair and begin to weep and howl and mourn and fast and wail. And so all this stuff is going on throughout the whole Medo-Persian Empire. In 12 months, every Jew is going to die, and all their stuff is going to be taken. Well, Esther hears about this, about her uncle has been seen out front making a fool of himself in sackcloth and ashes. She says, this is terrible. Sends a change of clothes for him. He refuses to put them on. And through messengers going back and forth, they have this conversation in chapter 4 that he sends back a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Shushan for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. So, hey, this is the law that the king just signed. So this is what's going on informationally, but now you need to go into the king and plead on behalf of you and your people. Well, she says, you know, you can't just walk into the king. She says that, and again, this is messengers back and forth, that everybody in the court knows that when you come to the king without being summoned, there's only one law. You'll be put to death. That is, unless the golden scepter is extended to you and the king shows grace to you and lets you live. But anybody who just walks in and says, king, I need to talk with you, they're put to death. And he says, she says, I haven't even seen the king for a month. I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. And so here's the deal. It's not like the Queen of England. It's the most favored woman in the harem. But the most favored woman in the harem hasn't even seen him for a month. And, well, again, through messengers, Mordecai said, well, you know, just because you're in the king's palace, don't imagine that you're going to escape any more than any of the Jews. And then he said something just that encourages me. In verse 14, he said, for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Man, there's a lot of doctrine in that statement. You know, the Jews are going to be delivered whether you act or not. There's a lot of things in life that we have to remind ourselves, you know, I messed up. And I failed to witness to that one person. And we can be condemned about that. But when we start discounting the sovereignty of God, the fact is, I will give an account for failing to be a witness. But if God has decreed that that person be saved, then he can use a donkey. You know, he can use a track blowing in the wind. He doesn't need me. Yeah, I missed my reward, and I'll be judged if I was disobedient and sinful. But God's plan will not be affected. It'll still happen. And the same with the Jews. He said, hey, Esther, you're in a unique position right now to attempt to save your people. But the fact is, the Jews are going to be saved anyway. But whether or not you are part of that is totally your choice. And he says, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? And I love that. This, you could write a book. You'd write volumes of books just accounting for people's lives who were in the most tumultuous, difficult, sinful kind of surroundings that just did not understand why they were there. People who might have sat in a situation and ended up in prison falsely accused. Again, I read in the paper the other day that because of DNA evidence, another guy on death row was acquitted. It was proven that after sitting on death row for 20 years through all these appeals, it was finally proven that he hadn't really done it. And he could have sat there like Joseph in prison and thought, I am innocent. What am I doing here? And despaired. But see, if the guy is a believer or has become a believer or will become a believer, then God will be able to say, you know, for such a time as this, I allowed you to do this. You may have been married to a psychotic, chemically dependent spouse. You may have gone through divorces or abuse or any number of things in your family and in your history. You may have gotten a horrible deal at work and were fired unjustly because of something someone else did. It doesn't matter. As long as you look at it through the eyes of the scriptural promise of God is causing all things to work together for good for those who love him, for those who are the called according to his purpose. Who knows that that didn't happen for such a time as this? For such a time that you may not even be aware of yet, that next Monday, next Sunday, 10 weeks from now, 10 months from now, 10 years from now, that you will finally realize, oh, it was for such a time as this that I made that dumb move, moved my family halfway across the country, and for what? That I made that dumb decision. It, you know, that applies to just about everybody in the room because let's face it, it's Cheyenne. And a lot of people move here and then their families go, what have you done to us? I love it here. But a lot of people I've encountered regret it. A dumb decision or circumstances beyond your control that just seem to mess everything up. Turmoil, difficulty, years of agony, whatever it might be. Why did this have to happen to me? Why did that guy have to be drunk and wipe out my kids or wipe out my car? Why did this have to? Why did this guy have to be so corrupt that he falsely accused me and I ended up going to jail for a month? Why? The eyes of faith believe and trust and see ahead for such a time as this. Again, we could write volumes and you could have a daily devotional for a whole year and the devotion every day would be this verse. Who knows, but for such a time as this. Why? Who knows? Only God knows. But the day's coming where it'll make sense. So Esther says, okay, all right. Here's your commitment. I'll do this. Here's your commitment. You've got to fast for 3 days. Assemble all the Jews, fast me for 3 days. I'll do the same thing. And then I'll go into the king, which is not according to the law, she interjects. And if I perish, I perish. So on the third day, it says in chapter 5, she goes in. And the king sees Esther, the queen, standing in the court. And she obtains favor in his sight. The king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. The king said to her, what is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Well, she doesn't come right out and say it. Instead, she says, let the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Well, that's odd. Why not just present the request? Why the banquet? Well, I like to put myself in people's places, and frankly, after I've been fasting for 3 days, I'd want to make a banquet too, you know. I don't know why this is, but it all just works out divinely, providentially. It all just seems to work out. So the king and Haman come to the banquet, which Esther had prepared, and they drank their wine at the banquet, and the king said to Esther, what is your petition? He obviously knew that something was troubling her, that she had a request. He knew that the banquet, what's your request? Oh, come to the banquet. You know, no, it wasn't an invitation and that was it. He knew there was something up. Well, he says, so what's the petition? She says, well, come to the banquet tomorrow. You know, you and Haman, come tomorrow and then I'll answer you. I'll do as the king says. I'll tell you what my petition is. So Haman has just had lunch with the king and queen. He's pretty full of himself at this point. He went out that day glad and pleased of heart, and he's like strutting around like a peacock, you know, and feeling really good about himself. But he goes through the king's gate, and everybody bows down except Mordecai. And it ruins his whole day. It makes him upset. It says that Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Isn't it funny how one person can ruin your whole day? Isn't it funny how, man, you could just be on top of the world and all it takes is one person to just, oh, ruined my day. Guess what? Nobody has the right or the ability to ruin your day. Nobody does. It's taken me a lot of years to figure that out. Because I lived a lot of years, even up till recently, letting one person ruin my day. You want to know who it was? No, I'll just no. It'll always be somebody different. Was it me? Was it me? Surely not I, Lord. You know, like you can be on top of the world, achieving all your goals, and you know, just everything's working out great, and all it takes is one dumb person to ruin your day. No. I discovered that nobody has the right to ruin my day, because God is still God. If the guy cuts me off, God is still God. If the gal speaks evil of me, God is still God. Somebody decides they don't like me and want to tell other people, you know what? God is still God. And you want to know what the secret to not letting them ruin your day is? Pray for those who persecute you. Bless those that curse you. It's so simple. And believe it or not, when you do it, it really works. Nobody has the right or the ability to ruin your day if you're blessing them and praying for them and loving them before God. It's interesting how freeing that is. What a life-changing experience it is to discover that the words of Jesus are so true. Well, he's mad. And so he says, you know what? Get all my friends together and bring my wife. Now, you didn't see the humor in that, but bring all my friends and my wife. Remember how women were treated in this society. He gets all his friends and his wife together, and it says in verse 11 that Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and the servants of the kings. Oh, as a matter of fact, he said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which he had prepared, and I'm also invited tomorrow too. This is why you sent for us, the friends must be thinking. Man, I thought the king's six-month party was bad, but you. He says, but none of this satisfies me. None of it. My life is great. Everything. I've attained everything I've ever wanted, but none of it is satisfying me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Well, his wife and all his friends said, well, just hang him. What's the problem? Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it, and then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. Wow, this is a sick society. Kill a guy in the morning, have a big lunch, take a nap, you know, read a book. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now, again, we see the hand of God. See, God, as I said, is not mentioned in this book, but you can't not see God in this book. That night, the king can't sleep. The king can't sleep. And so he remembers high school history class and how he was always able to sleep in high school history class. Man, I can't sleep. Bring the book of the Chronicles. Read it out loud to me. I'm guaranteed to fall asleep. Yeah, and you know that from high school. Nothing will put you to sleep faster than a high school history book, you know. Well, it was found written that Mordecai had reported these two guys that had tried to assassinate the king and how it was discovered. And they went on to the next story, and the king went, well, hold on, time out, I'm not asleep yet, now I got a question. What honor did we bestow upon Mordecai? Did we give him gold? I mean, did we promote him? Did we give him a job? What's the story? And what honor or dignity has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this? Well, the king's servants who attended him said, well, nothing has been done for him. So the king thinks, we got to resolve this now. Who's still in the palace? You know, it's bedtime. Who's still in the palace? Well, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows, which he had prepared for him. I love God. Who's out there? Well, Haman's out there. Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? What should we do? I want to honor somebody. What should we do for him? Well, Haman's thinking to himself, well, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Wow. Haman said to the king, oh, king, for the man the king desires to honor, oh, bring a royal robe that the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. And let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the whole city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Haman thinks, I'm writing my own ticket. Who does the king want to honor more than me? Oh, dress him up in the king's clothes, king. Parade him around on the king's horse and have one of the highest ranking officials parade him around and say that the king is wanting to honor him. He thinks, man, I'm writing my own ticket. This is great. The king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horses you have said and do so for Mordecai the Jew who is sitting at the king's gate. Oh, that's good. I love that. And he says, hey, don't fall short in anything of all that you have said. Oh, God is awesome. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. Well, Haman gets all his friends and his wife together again. Now what? And he told them everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife said to him, you know, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Oh, thanks for the advice. Just a few minutes ago, just a couple hours ago, you were saying, oh, you know, construct a gallows and hang him on it. Now you're saying, oh, by the way, if he's a Jew, you can't possibly have victory over him. You know, they knew something that a lot of the nations of the earth need to figure out, and they need to figure it out soon, but they won't. Is that God has promised to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their descendants that if you bless them, you'll be blessed. If you curse them, you will be cursed. They were told this. God has proven it out time and time and time again. As a matter of fact, you cannot find in history a nation, a group of people that has oppressed the Jews that have not been judged, that have not been, many of them, completely wiped out. Take, for example, the Egyptians. What did the Egyptians do to the Jews? Man, enslaved them, made them build the palaces, made them make bricks by treading straw into mud, And you know, that nation was the greatest nation on the face of the earth for decades and centuries. Have you been to Egypt lately? Have you been to Egypt lately? Have they repented? Well, I just caught on the news about 3 months ago that there is an organized effort now in the world courts that the Egyptians are suing the Jewish people because the night of the Exodus, the Jews stole all their gold. I am dead serious. I'm dead serious. I think there's no repentance there, and there's no blessing there. What was once the world's only superpower is now, well, it's Egypt. If you've been there, that's all the description you need. And you can go through history and see this. And it's interesting to watch the world's attitude towards the Jews and towards the nation of Israel and how it's changed just in the last few years even, how it's declined and gotten worse. And how, although we consider Israel one of our greatest allies, we're actively pursuing this idea of a coexisting Palestinian state and an Israeli state. We're in big trouble. We're in big, big trouble. As soon as we begin to curse the Jews, as soon as we begin to oppose them and say, no, God has not really given you this land, you need to give it back. There is no economic plan that can save our economy. There is no homeland defense that can protect us. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Pray for our leaders, because they don't yet realize what Haman's friend and Haman's wife knew. Man, if these people are of Jewish origin, you cannot overcome them. You will surely fall before them. Scary stuff. Pray for our leaders. And I find this interesting because I've recently had some threats accusing me of anti-Semitism. That some people have gotten onto our website and have misinterpreted some of the comments about the prophetic statements in the scriptures and have accused me of anti-Semitism and said they're going to continue to spread this, you know, how heinously anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic I am. They're going to sick the Jewish defamation league on me and stuff. And I'm hoping something comes of it. Because any opportunity I get, I mean, if the news comes and interviews me and says, okay, what's this about anti-Semitism? Then I'll be able to blow this horn that I've been blowing for decades now, which is the Jews are a blessed people of God, and if you oppose them, you will perish.
Well, that doesn't sound like anti-Semitism.
No, it doesn't, does it? Go ahead and broadcast it anyway. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that pans out, if it pans out. I know that Satan, if Satan sees that I'm not overreacting to it, he'll probably let it drop. But so let's all pretend that I'm scared. Oh, I hope nothing happens. All right. Well, he's just paraded Mordecai around the city center, saying, this is what's done to the man that the king wants to honor, and goes and tells everybody what happened. And they said, hey, you're going to fall before Mordecai if he's a Jew. Well, they're in the middle of this conversation, and the king's eunuchs show up and say, hey, man, it's lunchtime, you know. You got to go to the banquet, this second day banquet here. Well, the king and Haman and Esther are sitting here at this banquet, and the king says, Esther, my queen, my wife, what do you want? What's your petition? Well, she says, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request, because we've been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, you have to realize at this point that Haman had no clue that Esther was a Jew. She had hidden that. And as she starts saying, let my life be given me as a request, he's probably thinking, what is she talking about? And my people as my petition. What? Because we're supposed to be annihilated here pretty soon. Huh? And you can just, and remember, like 5 minutes before, he's had this conversation with his wife and friends about, hey, if this is a Jew, you're in big trouble. And now he's starting to put two and two together, and his eyes are probably as big as the saucers he's drinking out of. And the king says, who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus? Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this. And then the music swells up. Dun, 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 this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. You know, it's not always so good to be the only guy having lunch with the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace, or into the palace garden, but Haman stayed to beg for his life. And so he's pleading with her. He's had some wine. And the king, we already know, has an anger problem, and he kind of snaps to judgments. And now he's really justified in being angry, but alcohol is mixed in with there, and he just like stomps out into the garden. Well, Haman, like Queen Esther is sitting on this couch, on the royal couch, and he falls on this couch and he's begging for his life, please, 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 don't have me killed. Well, the king walks back in, and there's Haman on his wife's couch, you know. The king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? And as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. One of the eunuchs said, by the way, I got another piece of information here. The gallows standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high, he made for Mordecai, who was the guy who spoke good on behalf of the king. You got to wonder, Haman's face is covered a bit at this point, but you got to wonder if the writer of Esther didn't hear him go, why don't you mind your own business? Just the right piece of information at just the right time. Oh, by the way, Haman's house is a big gallows, and he was going to kill Mordecai. You know the guy that saved your life, king? He was going to kill him. Well, the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. You know, I'm reminded about the proverb, Proverbs 26 something. I'll just read the chapter and you can sit there quietly. It's actually the end of Proverbs 26. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone, it will come back on him. That's it. As soon as you start plotting, as soon as you start planning, as soon as you start figuring out, this is how I'm going to get that guy, this is how I'm going to ruin his reputation, this is how I'm going to smear this woman's character, this is how I'm going to make that couple's life miserable, you can be guaranteed that that pit you've dug, you will fall into it. It's a fact. Regardless of what your intentions are. You know, even if our idea, even if the motivation we have is because of righteousness, you know what? The Lord emphatically said, vengeance is mine. With the emphasis on the pronoun, mine. Vengeance is mine. We always think that's vengeance is mine. No, it's vengeance is mine. He said, I will repay. Don't take your own vengeance. Don't take your own revenge, beloved. Because vengeance, the Lord said, is mine. It belongs to me. So if you think, well, vengeance is mine and I just want to be about the Lord's business, so I'm going to dig this pit, I guarantee you'll fall into it. When you plan and you plot, you fall. It's the way it goes. Remember, we were just in, what minor prophet were we in recently? Micah. Micah, where he talked about the evil of men that go to bed at night and sit awake on their beds and plan about who they can mess with the next day. And they wake up the next day and they do it. God would judge them. Well, he's hanged on his own gallows. He who rolls a stone, the stone is going to roll right back on him. I'm reminded of the Wile E. Coyote cartoons, you know, where he's pushing the boulder up the hill and something happens and the boulder comes down the hill and now he's flat as a pancake. Well, you could pretty much think that at the end of chapter 7, end of story, right? End of book. But no, there's still this pesky thing about a law has been decreed that all the Jews are going to be killed on the 13th day of the 12th month. So chapter 8 starts out, verse 3, Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman. And he said, you know, they go through this conversation, and it says in verse 8 that a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. I can't revoke this. It's a done deal. The law, interesting enough, in the Medo-Persian Empire, we see historically that the law was higher in position than the king who wrote it. That the law actually had more significance and prominence and authority than even the king who originally authored the law. And so he said, well, I can't revoke it. I mean, you can do what you want, but I don't know what you're going to do. Well, as it turned out, that the plan they came up with was that the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city, it says in verse 11, the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy and to annihilate and kill the entire army of any people which might attack them, and to plunder their spoil. So now it's a two-sided battle. You think, that doesn't sound like a great solution to me. Couldn't they have come up with something better? Well, I'll tell you, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because God's people here are given victory when they're told that they have the right to defend themselves. That's the same thing God's done for us. We've got an enemy that wants to steal from us, wants to kill us, wants to destroy us. And what does God tell us to do? Defend yourself. What does it say in Ephesians? It says in the book of Ephesians, chapter 6, I'm almost certain. Chapter 6, verse 10, finally be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. He's saying standing firm. So that you will be able to attack the devil with your spear. No, you put on the armor, the defensive weaponry, so that you'll be able to stand firm. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm. God knows that this is actually the best solution. How can my people have victory? Tell them they can defend themselves. Tell my people they can defend themselves. It's as simple as that. And so it actually is a great solution. And we go through chapter 9. It describes all the couriers going out. And chapter 9 talks about how they assembled. Ultimately, it says in verse 5, thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword. And so they were actually victorious. But it also says that they, in verse 10, that they did not lay their hands on the plunder. You know, it's not anti-Semitic to recognize anti-Semitism. And the people that hate the Jews accuse them of being money-grubbing, gold-digging, money-hungry. That's the way they stereotype the Jews. Well, I see historically a different story. I see a different picture painted here. They didn't lay their hands on the plunder. The law said, hey, all these people that you kill, you can lay your hand, you can take all their stuff. The Jews said no. They said no. Well, it says in verse 20 that Mordecai recorded these events and sent letters to all the Jews declaring this annual feast, this annual celebration, and they would call it Purim. It says in verse 26 that they called these days Purim after the name of Pur, because the Pur had been cast, the lot had been cast. And so now every year the Jews celebrate Purim. They read the book of Esther. Every time Haman's name is mentioned, they hiss and stamp their feet, and it's a good old time. Especially when you know that he's going to end up hung on his own gallows. That's pretty cool. Ultimately, the way this book ends is in chapter 10, verse 3, Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus. and great among the Jews and in favor with his many kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people and who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. Man, I hope that each of us go down in God's eternal history with this same description. Because there are many genuinely anti-Semitic people around. I'm not one of them. I hope that when I get to heaven, that one of my greatest rewards will be God will say, you know what? You spoke for the good of my people, the Jews, and that you cared about the nation of the Jews, and that you prayed continually for the peace of my people and their nation. And so great is your reward for that. I will bless you because you bless them. And it's important to notice that these folks weren't completely righteous. They hadn't gone with Ezra. They hadn't gone earlier with Shealtiel or Zerubbabel, one of those guys with a funny name. I think it was Zerubbabel. They hadn't gone back to Jerusalem. They had their problems. They made their bad decisions. Israel today, not making all the best decisions, but I support them anyway. Israel, are they completely righteous? Not in the slightest. Many of them have forsaken the spiritual aspect of following God and instead have become Jews by heritage and not by religion, that they have become humanists, very many of them. But I support the nation and I support it unconditionally, not because they're always right, but because God is always in control. And so I think that's an important thing, because you'll hear people making valid statements. Hey, Israel shouldn't have done this. They shouldn't have acted in this way. Hey, maybe not. But I'm not going to speak against them. I'm not going to stand up and say, Israel, you are wrong. I curse you for this. Oh, no. Any more than Mordecai. He could have gone down in history as a guy who rebuked the Jews for not leaving the Medo-Persian Empire and going back to Israel. Instead, he goes down in history as a guy who spoke for the good of the people and for his nation. And I hope all of us end up with that same blessing. Let's pray.